the land of the rising scrum on Off the Ball.
Yeah, you're very welcome to episode 6 this week of Land of the Rising Scrum, where one by one we're working our way through the World Cup pools to profile every single team that's going to be playing at Japan in this year's Rugby World Cup. Last week we brought you the first of our former World Cup winning teams in New Zealand, and this week we're delighted to say we're moving on to another former World Cup winning side, South Africa, a side that are going to be of big interest for Ireland, potentially in a World Cup quarter-final, all things going to plan, that we think anyway. So joining me throughout this podcast is going to be a former World Cup winner in 1995, Cobus Visa, and also Gavin Rich, the rugby writer from South Africa as well. First, though, Cobus is on the line. Cobus, good morning and thanks a million for taking our call.
Big pleasure. Nice chatting to you guys.
Cobus, I would imagine as a 1995 World Cup winner, always in big demand around the time that a Rugby World Cup comes around.
Yeah, it's very special. World Cup time is the sort of the pinnacle. It's the cherry on the cake for every rugby player and every rugby playing nation, and every proud rugby playing nation, as South Africa and Ireland and New Zealand and the rest. So it's a big one. It's an interesting one in Japan. It could be a great World Cup, and I think it could be a World Cup that could up again and show us a few surprises.
Yeah, I mean, we had one big, massive surprise at the last World Cup when South Africa were beaten by Japan in the opening round of games.
Well, I was hoping you weren't going to mention that because that still hurts us very, very badly. And it's something that I think every Springbok supporter wants to forget as soon as possible. But on the day, they were the better team. It was probably the biggest shock of World Cup rugby. That's the beauty of World Cup rugby. It shows you that the so-called minnows, the smaller teams, are less well-known rugby countries in the world, like Japan, has grown tremendously. And we saw what that win meant to them. It was to the detriment of South Africa, but it was a huge boost for Japanese rugby.
How did South Africa go about actually picking themselves up after that? Because in the end, it actually turned out to be, overall, they were actually quite impressive at times, getting to the semi-final, like ran New Zealand pretty close in the end in that semi-final and ultimately finished third in the World Cup. Like, did it surprise people how well they picked themselves up afterwards, or were they just kind of constantly kind of looking back on that game in Japan, just standing out as a big sore thumb in the end?
I think it was just one of those unexplained crazy days where the Springbok side unfortunately didn't turn up, taking nothing away from Japan on the day. I say again, they played better rugby. South Africa made wrong calls, terrible mistake, wrong choices, and so forth. So we paid the price. But yes, they came back. South Africa has always been a nation that's proud of our sport. And when it comes to the Springboks as well, you know, the people, they support the Springboks 100%. And it showed that, you know, they, after that, they took a lot of abuse. And obviously, rightfully so, but they bounced back. And when the chips is down, the Springbok side has always shown that they will turn up.
Over the last few years, then, they've gone on quite a journey. They've really hit rock bottom at one stage a couple of years ago, but they do seem to be slowly picking themselves back up, I think, are they?
Yes, it's been a rollercoaster ride. I mean, it's not South African rugby overall. It's not where it's supposed to be, should be, because I think a lot of reasons for that, and the Rusty Erasmus has got a massive task on his hands. I think talent, talent probably the most testing talent in the world, players-wise and so forth. There's an incredible young talent coming through. We see it year by year. I think the biggest task and the most difficult task for us would be which combinations, which players to pick in certain positions. You know, and as you know, it makes a lot of sense also, and it's proven in the past that World Cups have been won by the teams that pick the best informed players at that stage.
Mm-hmm. Looking back at your own days, obviously, we have to discuss 1995, the incredible occasion that was. But I was looking through the squads coming up to this, and I was looking at the South Africa squad, and it was jumping out at me that just seven of the entire squad of the South African team in 1995 had more than 10 test caps. And I was trying to think about why, like, I was looking at it going, God, that seems quite strange. But it had only occurred to me a couple of minutes later, obviously, up until 1992 and 1993, South Africa had been under the suspension from Test rugby because of apartheid, and it had really only just jumped out at me last night just how inexperienced a Test level year 1995 squad was going into that World Cup.
Yes, that's true, but you must remember that at that stage what helped, I think, the South African side is the Currie Cup system was very strong. You saw Currie Cup games on Saturdays in South Africa where Northern Transvaal would play Western Province or Transvaal would play Natal, and they would probably be it would probably be like similar to test sides playing each other with full stands. So that's all we had at that stage. That kept our rugby alive and strong. And then Super Rugby was introduced as well. So it helped a bit. But yes, you're right. We were inexperienced at test level, but I think the hunger and I think the talent was always there. It was just a matter of time.
Did you think by that stage maybe your opportunity to feature for the Springboks had passed?
Well, the dream was always there. I think for any youngster, like they dream to play for their country, and the dream was always there. You know, you work towards that. And one day when we were introduced back into rugby, we knew, and luckily it was in our own country. But there was a lot of downside to that. We didn't have a lot of time to prepare before we knew that, probably 2 years, 2.5 years. But again, I think the hunger kicked in. I think we were so happy about the opportunity to play in the World Cup again and in our own country, and the people just embraced it.
What was the goal realistically for you coming into the tournament? Because it did end up being quite a surprise for most people, I think, on the outside, that South Africa went on to win it. Coming into the tournament, was that the goal for you, even though in theory you were very inexperienced at test level? Did you still think you had it in you to go all the way and win it?
I don't want to sound arrogant, but I mean, when we knew we were back into it and we had the opportunity to play, the whole focus from the coaching staff, from Saru, from the players, were that it's in our own country. It's a huge opportunity. We need to make use of it. And that's the way we trained. That's how we focused. That was our whole plan to work towards that. You know, we had great support, unbelievable support from the nation. And we had this dream, the group of players that all bought into the same dream. We trained exceptionally hard. If I say that, I mean, we were exceptionally fit. And we kept on, you know, saying to each other, we've got one common goal, and it's to work towards a victory for this opportunity we have in our own country.
Mm-hmm. And even aside from the team itself, did it feel like it was the first big tournament, big major sporting event to be held in South Africa since the end of apartheid? Was there a pressure on the country to actually put on a show and show the world that it is a changed nation?
Yes, I think there was. There was sort of this expectation, not only from ourselves, because as I said, you know, we sacrificed so many years and waited so long for this opportunity. We got this chance and we knew we had to use it and we focused it. But the nation was sort of quietly confident, quietly behind the side, and also from a guy like the president, you know, Mandela, who visited us a couple of times, and we became very friendly with him, said, you know, there's a huge opportunity for us, there's a huge responsibility. The nation is behind us, and we need to do well, because this could mean a lot to the country, not only on the field, but off the field.
Meeting someone like Nelson Mandela, I can only imagine, was a phenomenally inspiring thing to have happened to you.
Yes, he was a great person. I mean, we enjoyed him. He had a great sense of humour. He was a very down-to-earth man, and he wanted to learn more about the game. He wanted to meet every player. And as I said, we became good friends with him. After that, the team regularly had dinner with him. As I said, he loved the sport. He loved the idea that at that stage of the history of the country, that this team sort of brought people together and with success, which was a great blessing.
Mm-hmm. As the tournament progressed, then you get as far as the semi-final, and there's that semi-final against France where the people thought it was going to be rained off entirely. The game is delayed for an hour, and had that rain continued to come, South Africa would have gone out of the tournament, France into the final, because of the fact that they had a better disciplinary record. When the skies cleared and the game was called that it was all right to play and you were able to get out onto the pitch, did it just feel like there was a little bit of fate developing here, that the, you know, almost like the kind of stars were aligning for South Africa to go through in this tournament?
Well, not really, because with the amount of water that was falling in Durban at that stage, the game was in balance, the pressure was mounting. As you mentioned, if the game didn't continue, we would have been out of the World Cup. But then a lovely Welshman by the name of Mr. Bevan continued and said, no, we need to play, and we did. And then the circumstances, the conditions were horrific, you know. And then again, we played. Nobody knows when they will turn up on a rugby match. You know, they're unpredictable. They're a good world rugby side. and all the conditions was sort of against all players on the field. It was very difficult to play, and it was playoff time. So once you had this once opportunity to progress or not progress, we also had certain players that had underlying injuries. So it was massive pressure besides just playing the game and winning it. But I think it illustrated the belief of this side. It was mentally a very strong side. We were superbly fit, and we believed in our goal. Despite all these curveballs thrown to the side, I think the side stuck to their guns and had huge belief and huge faith in each other and what we're working towards.
And when the final whistle went in that game against France and you knew you were into a final, I can imagine, given the stress and anxiety of that entire day when you're wondering, were you even going to get onto the pitch in the first place? I'd say just an incredible amount of relief is the main feeling.
Yeah, absolutely. Spot on. Like you said, you know, it is what you work towards the tournament, and then you play the old enemy, the All Blacks, and you play them in Johannesburg at one of the world's greatest rugby stadiums, certainly one of my favourites. And it's probably going to be in bright sunshine. It's a dream final from a South African point of view. So, yes, but then again, what happened up to that moment is in the past, and then you start refocusing, reworking in that week towards the final.
And the day of the final, the World Cup final against New Zealand, like how much do you remember maybe of the afternoon leading up towards kickoff? Like, was it nerves? Was it apprehension? Excitement? All of those emotions kind of rolled into one.
Well, Neil, I think it was a combination of all of those. You know, I mean, you live it by the minute, by the second. So you realize in your mind, unfortunately, sometimes start playing tricks, and you think, well, have we done enough? Are we well prepared? Are we prepared to the best of our ability? And you know, this is a once in a lifetime opportunity, and you've sacrificed so many years of your life training for this, that you have no choice but to do it 100% and go all the way. So, but again, you know, I remember clearly we could have done nothing more. We did everything we could to get to the final. The opportunity was there. The only thing left was just to use the opportunity.
And like of the game itself, how much of that do you remember? Is it a bit of a blur? Do you need to watch it back to remind yourself of it?
No, clearly. I mean, you remember every minute, every second where everything happened. I mean, I know it was a close score, but we never felt. And again, without sounding arrogant, I've got great respect for New Zealand, but I thought the score could have been bigger. There were two or three moments where we thought we scored tries, which was disallowed by Ed Morrison, which would have made a big difference. We were up front. We had the upper hand as well. Defense was solid. So we thought, although, again, it was close, it was a game that we deserved to win.
And as it's coming into extra time then as well, is that still what you're thinking? That, you know, you have this idea in your head, we are the better team in this game. We just have to make it count, put a point on the board.
Exactly. In New Zealand, there's no doubt New Zealand was the favourites going into the tournament and also into the final. And we knew that and we were comfortable with that. The fact remained that that is exactly what was said amongst ourselves going for the extra time, is that stick to our game plan. It's working for us. New Zealand was starting to panic a bit because they couldn't penetrate the defences and it didn't work for them. So that was basically it.
And then the full-time whistle does go. You are the world champions. What's that feeling like?
Well, you know, you've probably been asked that question a million times and you can give a million answers. But for me personally, it was like a mountain being lifted from your shoulders. You know, you could breathe again because of all the expectation, all the pressure from ourselves, pressure from outside and so forth. But it was a very humbling feeling, but an immense feeling.
Did you feel like you had brought a country together? Like, that's what we've always been told down the years, that, you know, this the idea of the Rainbow Nation and, you know, everyone came together in 1995 and celebrated the Springboks. Did you feel that that happened?
Well, we've seen that building up to it and definitely after the game and for months and years after it, there's no doubt whatsoever. After the game, throughout South Africa, you know, there was not anybody going to bed. It was just a huge celebration, which we were, again, very blessed and very proud and fortunate to be part of.
And looking at 2009, quickly before we wrap up, what are the chances of William Webb Ellis going back to South Africa in a few months' time?
We would love to say yes. There's a definite chance, and there is. I think it's more open to certain countries that are real contenders without any doubt as well. this World Cup in Japan. That's why I said we could see a few surprises. There's no doubt. Again, we have the talent. And if Rossi picks the right side, South Africa will definitely be a very serious contender.
And just as well, you mentioned earlier on just about how your own side, you had this kind of a natural arrogance, even though you weren't playing Test rugby, that, you know, we are South Africa, we are one of the biggest rugby countries in the world. Is that something that has always stood to South African sides, even when they haven't necessarily been great teams, when they've got as far as the kind of quarterfinals, that they know what it's like to be in that situation? Whereas a team like Ireland, for example, we've never been past a quarterfinal. That is the mountain for Ireland to get past. Whereas for a country like South Africa, it's expected that you're beyond it.
Well, I wouldn't call it arrogance. I don't think South Africa has ever been arrogant, but we're a proud nation when it comes to rugby. We are a competitive nation. We would like to think that South Africa has contributed, like many other countries, vastly to the game of rugby worldwide, and will continue to do that. So I think it's important for the likes of South Africa, New Zealand, Ireland, England, these older nations, bigger nations, that they keep on performing at a top level, but also very important that we contribute towards the game. So, yes, there's a big expectation from the South African nation, because we are sports lovers like the Irish, like the Kiwis, like the Pommies, so forth. So for South Africa not to get to the playoff stages will be unacceptable from a supporter's point of view and from a country's point of view.
Okay, Cobus, thanks a million for joining us this morning on Land of the Rising Scrum.
Pleasure, mate. Anytime. Have a good day.
Thank you. Yeah, that was Cobus Visa there, 1995 Rugby World Cup winner with the Springboks. Now looking at the current crop of players, I have a rugby writer and author of The Poison Chalice and the Springbok Coaches, Gavin Rich. Gavin, thanks a million for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Neil.
I'm going to cut right to the chase. South Africa are of big interest to Ireland here in the Rugby World Cup this year, because if all goes according to the plan that we have laid out anyway, we want Ireland to finish top of their pool. We are expecting, you might disagree now, that South Africa will probably finish second in their pool behind New Zealand, setting up a quarterfinal between Ireland and South Africa in Japan. How far have South Africa come over the last couple of years? Because 2 years ago, they were absolutely hammered out of the gate in Dublin. But since last summer, beating New Zealand, a Test Series win against England, there seems to be a lot more optimism over the last year or so than there probably had been over the course of the previous World Cup cycle.
Well, yes, Neil. They've got a proper coach now. Rossy Erasmus, I think, is quite well known to people in Ireland after he coached Munster. So they've got a very good coach who organises well and who selects well, and who did a good job of preparing a team last year that had most of its focus for most of the year on the World Cup. I got quite frustrated at times, because I felt there were times when they didn't select their best team. I think that possibly the most notable example of that was the third test against England down here in Cape Town. They could have actually whitewashed England quite easily in that series, but they decided to experiment a bit. But it's understandable. I mean, we had a new coach in charge. There has been a lot of progress made. If you look, you know, our big opponents are always New Zealand. And a couple of years ago, the All Blacks beat South Africa on home soil, 57-15. A year after that, it was 57-0. In Albany, in the away game against the All Blacks. But last year, not only did South Africa win the game in Wellington, they were a little bit lucky to win that game in Wellington, but then when they played them on home soil in Pretoria last year, they actually outplayed them for most of the game before, in my view, some rather odd late substitutions let the All Blacks back in. And you know how well the All Blacks can finish. So they won that game in the last move of the game. But South Africa did, well, I wouldn't say they had the wood over New Zealand, but they certainly were very competitive against New Zealand last year. So, although I would agree with you that second place in the pool is a probability, I wouldn't write off the prospect of South Africa beating New Zealand in that pool game and actually finishing top of their pool. It is possible. Mm-hmm. If there is a team that can beat New Zealand, in fact, I think there are quite a few that probably can beat New Zealand, but South Africa do have a good record against New Zealand. If you look back historically, you know, they've probably beaten them more than any other team has. If any team is going to beat New Zealand in the pool stage, it would be a team like South Africa. So, yeah, maybe we won't be seeing you in the quarterfinals.
Yeah, who knows? Absolutely. Now, things didn't really go according to plan in the autumn series in the Northern Hemisphere for South Africa. Is that I think a lot of that was probably down to there were selection problems. There were players kind of being made unavailable through club commitments in the Northern Hemisphere. Is that something you're just not really reading too much into?
No, look, I think that Rossi might have made some mistakes on the Northern Tour. I thought there were a couple of selection mistakes. I think that there was also that refereeing issue in the game in Twickenham, which the Springboks should probably have won, and they dominated that game for much of it, and then threw it away in the second half. But I don't read too much into the Northern Hemisphere tours. Just like, to be honest, I don't read too much into England coming out here and getting beaten last year, just because I think that the end of a season. For both hemispheres, when you guys come here to the north and to the south and we go to you, I think just at the end of a long season, it's very hard for the guys to get up and I think that you've got to put it into context. I think in a World Cup year it's different, obviously, because all the teams go into camps. I think that's one of the reasons why a team like Wales has often been better in the world. Well, certainly under Warren Gatland, they've been better in World Cup years than they have been at other times. Certainly they were in 2011. And I think that might be the case this year. It's very hard to look back at a end of season tour, whether it's the Northern Hemisphere coming here or the South going to the North, and say, well, you know, that shows how strong the teams are. I mean, for instance, I don't think that All Black team that played against you last year was a fresh team. I mean, they're going to be a very different proposition when you play them in the World Cup, a much better, a different proposition. I would say possibly 40% better. Mm. It really is hard to read into what happens in November.
Yeah, I always find it is difficult to kind of gauge the dynamic, I suppose, of the time when the Rugby World Cup is, because from a Northern Hemisphere's team point of view, it is right at the start of your season. Like, for example, the Irish players have started up their World Cup camp as of 3 days ago, whereas their season only ended 3 or 4 weeks ago. Now, they're going to have a couple of little mini breaks in between that. And from the Southern Hemisphere team's point of view, their World Cup is going to be coming right at the end of their season, having gone through a Super Rugby campaign, Rugby Championship, which is starting again in about a month's time. Like, how difficult is it to balance, I suppose, the energy of the players coming through such a long Super Rugby season? It's granted, it's abridged Rugby Championship. It's only three rounds, but it's still a lot of rugby. Is there just a lot of game management to be done for all of those teams throughout the season? Kind of the unions dealing with the clubs, etc.
I think what you said initially is right. It requires management. It does. It requires very good management. I think all three Southern Hemisphere nations have managed their players, or they've tried to manage their players well during Super Rugby. You don't have the top players playing all the games, but at the same time, there's still been injuries, and a lot of guys are injured at the moment. I mean, Ludovic Müller, I've almost forgotten the guy's surname. But Luit Diaga, the big Bulls lock, never played a single game this year because he was injured. He might be getting to the World Cup feeling that he needs games because he hasn't played this year. And there are a few guys like that, but there've been a lot of niggling injuries just lately. The Stormers have basically half the bulk of the Springbok pack, and most of those guys were out injured at the end of the season, which is why the Stormers imploded and never made the Super Rugby playoffs. Those guys all need management. I'm talking about guys like Peter Steffetoy, who's a very good player, Asia Khaleesi, the Springbok captain. He's out for another 4 weeks or so. Eben Etzebeth is out for a good while yet now as well. And he may even miss the Rugby Championship. So there's actually a couple of issues facing Rossie Erasmus. One of them is that, yes, the Super Rugby season has been a long and arduous one, and it's very attritional, and guys are carrying very sore bodies at the moment. But at the same time, as you say, the Springboks aren't playing a lot of games. They don't have a lot of games still to come because the Rugby Championship has been abridged, and then they only play one other game against Argentina in addition to that. So there are four games to come. But, you know, speaking to Rossi, I get the impression that he's going to be wanting to rest his full-strength team for a couple of those. And there are some of us who are asking, well, it is possible that the Springboks might get to the World Cup underdone. You know, there have been World Cups in the past where you could say the Springboks could warm up during the tournament in the sense that they've started off against a lesser team. And the pool...
Well, that's exactly what happened in 2015, isn't it? The game against Japan. And they worked their way into it.
Exactly. Exactly. Like a game against Japan. I mean, we thought that he could warm up slowly for that tournament. It bit us on the day. But that has been the perception in the past. I'm doing a book where I spoke to Farida Priya, the former Springbok scrum half, and he spoke about that year, about how he was planning only to really come back and start once the playoffs arrived, and he thought that they could just sail through the pool stages. And it was after the Japanese game that he suddenly realised, okay, well, I have to actually play now because, you know, we have a bit of a problem. But, you know, there have been years where South Africa started off, well, actually all teams start off against one of the minnow nations, and then you can warm up. But this year they're starting off against the All Blacks. It's a massive game, so they need to hit the tournament running. And that's why they've organised an extra game, which actually, funnily enough, is against Japan, a friendly game 2 weeks before the tournament. So I think Russie will probably play his top team then. And I think that dress rehearsal game might even be more important in the long run than some of the Tri-Nations games or rugby championship games that they're playing before that. But you are right, there's going to be a lot of management, and from both sides. I mean, you've got to basically make sure that everybody's fit and fresh, and you've also at the same time got to make sure that they're not underplayed, which I think could also be a problem. But then I suppose certainly the Southern Hemisphere coaches face that challenge. I mean, it's not unique to South Africa. But just looking back at the World Cups, you know, you talk about the placement of the World Cup in the season. I remember in 2011 when the World Cup was in New Zealand, Australia looked... We were brilliant in most of that year. In 2011, they won the Tri-Nations and the Reds won Super Rugby. But by the time they got to New Zealand for the World Cup proper, they were out on their feet. You may remember that there were a lot of injuries, and they played with a very decimated team for much of that competition. And although they somehow made the semi-final by beating South Africa in a game that I think was, well, most people would agree was influenced very heavily by the referee Bryce Lawrence, they made the semi-finals that year. The Australians, you may remember, they actually lost to you guys along the way.
Yeah, they did.
Pool stages. They did. Australia that year were very decimated. I mean, they weren't the same team by the time they got to the World Cup that I believe that they would have been if we played that World Cup in July. So it is a very fine balancing act, because you can get it horribly wrong. And I think Australia got it wrong that year.
From the Super Rugby season this year, obviously we are still a few months away from the World Cup, so there is going to be, you know, there's a lot of time for players to come in and out and injuries picked up and whatever. But have there been any kind of potential bolters from the Super Rugby season that have stood out that maybe have a chance of sneaking into a squad?
Well... not so much from outside of the squad, but there's been some guys who've played that are part of the extended squad who have played well. He could sort of come into the reckoning as start, you know, come into the starting team. Damien Willemsen was really good at that fullback for the Stormers in Super Rugby, although Billy LaRue, I think, is probably a confirmed starter at fullback for the Box. But I think Damien's proven that he's probably the best backup in that position. There haven't been too many, to be honest. There's been a lot of wings. A lot of wings have done really well. Cornel Hendricks, who you may remember was a Springbok a couple of years ago and then left the game because he had a heart condition. And it still worries me that he's playing with that heart condition. Yeah. But anyway, he is. He's come back to the game very successfully, and he scored some really, really good tries. Makazoli Mpimpi, who's a... He's very quick. He's lightning quick. He used to play for the Kings, not in Pro 14 era Kings, but certainly in Super Rugby before that. Makazoli Mpimpi has got a better all round game now than he had 2 years ago, and is looking a real sort of strong contender to play on the wing for the Springboks and the starting team as well. Otherwise, I'm trying to think out of the top of my head. There's not too many that have come out of nowhere. There are a lot of young forwards coming through. There's a guy, Kobus Visser, who's been brilliant for the Stormers. He's only 21 years old, and many consider him to be as good as Eben Etzebeth, but now he's injured himself. He's just injured his knee.
Is he Kobus's son?
Beg your pardon?
Is he Kobus' son?
No relation.
Oh.
No relation.
Because we just spoke to Kobus about 20 minutes ago.
Okay. No. There are a lot of young forwards coming through, but you know, I don't think, unless there's injuries, I don't think that Russie would need to dip into that reservoir just yet. So there's somebody. Sorry, the Stormers scrum half. the Stormers scrum half, Herschel Yanchis. He missed the last game of the season because of injury, but it's not a serious injury. He's really established himself as a good young scrum half. So he could well come into the mix ahead of Arvin van Zyl and Ambrose Papier. So I expect that Tuff de Klerk would be the shoo-in as the starting scrum half at the World Cup, but I wouldn't be surprised if Rossi doesn't bring in Herschel Yanchis from nowhere to be part of the squad.
From a coaching and management point of view, the last 4 years have so much has happened in this World Cup cycle, pretty much for South Africa. If you can, I might just ask you if you could kind of give our listeners maybe a potted history, in so many words, of what has kind of gone on over the last few years since the last Rugby World Cup, which has led to Razzie Erasmus coming in as director of rugby, and for the time being, at least, he's now the head coach as well.
Well, the one thing that South Africans have never done well when it comes to their national team is hold on to their RP. So when a World Cup cycle comes to an end, we don't just change the coach, we change everyone. And you have a whole new team of management guys coming in, a whole new group of coaches. Johan van Kraan admittedly stick around for a year or two with Peter de Villiers before heading over to your side. But otherwise, there was a complete turnover of coaches, and also to some extent a bigger turnover of players this last time than there has been in the past. There was the end of a very definite cycle in 2015 as far as the Springbok players were concerned, the likes of Victor Matfield and Jean de Villiers and all those guys retiring. Alistair Kutsia came in and he took over as the Springbok coach. He was, I think to say that he wasn't successful would be an understatement. In fact, he started, you'll recall, he started his tenure in Cape Town against Ireland in June of 2016. And it was the first home defeat suffered against you guys by the Springboks.
Yeah.
In retrospect, maybe we made too much of that. I don't think we knew quite as good as. I don't think we realised how good Ireland were at that particular stage. I think that you guys have really done well in this World Cup cycle, and maybe we didn't realise just how good Ireland were then. But it did send the alarm bells. So he started off his tenure under intense pressure. We eventually won. Well, the Springboks eventually won that series very narrowly, by clinching it, if I remember correctly. It was in Port Elizabeth, very narrowly, but in a game that Ireland could easily have won. They then went on to play in a rugby championship, which started okay, but then went pear-shaped when they lost to Argentina overseas, and then they lost to the All Blacks in Durban. I mean, it's a home game. They lost 57-15, as I mentioned earlier. So that was a massive defeat, and that sent a lot of alarm bells ringing through South African rugby. There was a big coaching seminar in Cape Town which was called by Alistair Kutsia. And everybody sat down with this big powwow about how to take South African rugby seriously. Forward. And there were a lot of decisions made about trying to upskill the players and improving the coaching. And, you know, to be honest, coaching is a massive problem in this country. I mean, our coaching just isn't up to scratch. And then he went into the second year, and the second year was a bit better. They played against a quite weak France team in the home series and won that one quite easily. And then they beat Argentina quite comprehensively at the start of the rugby championships. But when they got to Albany and played against the All Blacks and lost 57-0, I think that was the end of. That was when it was decided that we couldn't continue with Alistair Kutsia, and it got worse from there. You mentioned earlier the tour that South Africa undertook to the Northern Hemisphere at the end of 2017, and I think the game against Ireland was probably the low point. But there were a couple of low points on that tour, and it says something that. It's been quite a long time now since South Africa last beat Wales. And, you know, I was brought up to believe that South Africa would always beat Wales because until 1999, South Africa had never lost to Wales. I think we're sitting now with a record which is, I think, five or six games in a row that the Welsh have won against the Springboks. The Irish have a fairly good recent record against the Springboks. So do England, if you consider that. They won the last test of that last tour, and then when we went over there, we lost to Twickenham. Mm. So, it's been a tough 4 year cycle in the sense that along the way they also lost to Italy. I don't know if you remember that game, but they lost to Italy at the end of 2016 as well. That was another blot on Alistair Kutsia's record. I mean, he lost to both Argentina and he lost to Italy, two nations of Springboks.
aren't supposed to lose to, or at least in the past they weren't supposed to lose to. So it's been an interesting four-year cycle, but I think that Rusty did turn it around last year by beating the All Blacks in Wellington and all but beating them again in Pretoria. I mean, South Africa were a couple of seconds away last year from winning twice against the All Blacks, and I think that's possibly the biggest source of hope for South Africans. In the recent Super Rugby season, there wasn't too much success for South Africans against New Zealand teams in Super Rugby, but the Crusaders, who are by far and away the best team in Super Rugby, they were held to draws twice, once by the Sharks in Christchurch and the other time by the Stormers in Cape Town. Both of them were games that the South African teams could quite easily have won. So there is a sort of competitiveness against New Zealand that maybe there wasn't at the beginning of this four-year cycle. So that's why I say that it's been an interesting four-year cycle. It started off spectacularly poorly, but it's starting to stabilise a bit now. Whether it's going to be stabilised enough by the time we go to the World Cup, I don't know. But I think things are starting to come right in South African rugby. I think the next four-year cycle could be a good one for South Africa.
And just finally, before I leave you go, Gavin, one final question. If it is Ireland against South Africa in a World Cup final, given the fact that Ireland have never been beyond that stage of the tournament, given the fact that South Africa are past masters of just working their way through a tournament and grinding out the wins and, you know, building on that experience, would you be leaning towards South Africa?
Phew, I don't know. I'd have to watch the games that precede it. I mean, yeah. You know, the form that Ireland show in the tournament. I mean, Ireland, if they can beat the All Blacks like they did last year, then they can beat South Africa. And South Africa haven't beaten Ireland a lot in recent times. So, you know, I'd have to watch the tournament and watch the two teams play before answering that question. But you know, my gut feel is that the three teams that have the best chance at this World Cup are England, New Zealand, and South Africa. And I say England because I just have a very high regard for John Mitchell and for Eddie Jones. And I think that Eddie Jones's knowledge of the Japanese conditions might be underestimated by pundits ahead of this World Cup. So I've just got a funny feeling that England are going to have a really strong World Cup, and All Blacks obviously are favourites. And South Africa, I would have said Ireland at the end of November last year, but after the recent Six Nations, I changed my tune a bit. Look, Wales obviously are going to challenge as well. I mean, there are probably five teams that can win the World Cup, but my gut feel is that it will be one of those three teams that I mentioned. And I suppose that does answer your question. So if South Africa are in a final against Ireland, I would probably just ever so slightly lean towards South Africa.
Gavin Rich, thanks a million for joining us this afternoon.
No problem at all. Enjoyed it.
The Land of the Rising Scrum on Off the Ball.